Hello, it's John Dennis here on Tuesday, October the 28th. Today, nervousness on the world's markets after another bout of panic selling as the world heads for recession.
A half point cut is very much in the market, and there are people talking about a full percentage point cut, which would take them down to 3.5%. That would be obviously the biggest cut there's been by the Bank of England since it was given independence.
Peter Mandelson tells The Guardian there was no conflict of interest in his dealings with the Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska.
How will knowing how many times I have met someone tell you whether I have acted with propriety? That's the key issue. Not how many times, but what I did.
And we're in the final straight in the US elections. Obama and McCain slug it out in the key states. We'll look today at the other elections taking place in America next week, to the House of Representatives and Congress.
In order for Democrats to reach this magic number of 60 senators, they have to fight extra hard in swing states. There are 12 particular swing states for the Democratic Senate.
But first, the news headlines and a quick look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
The Bank of England says there should be a fundamental reform of the world banking system to avoid a repeat of the present crisis. In its half-yearly report, the bank says the crash has cost the world $2.8 trillion. It says tougher regulation and controls on lending money are needed in a fundamental rethink. One business that's doing well is oil. BP is expected to announce a 50% increase in profits because of the record prices over the last quarter of the year. It's expected the firm will have made more than £4 billion in profit between July and September. While the economic crisis means that many are facing losing their jobs, finance workers will stage a protest outside Parliament today about how the banking bailout works. The Union Unite says that they want jobs and communities protected, not bonuses for the bosses. In Africa, the latest attempt to enact the peace agreement in Zimbabwe has failed. President Robert Mugabe and the winner of the recent election, Morgan Tsvangirai, have yet again failed to agree on how cabinet seats should be shared out in a new government. All of the country's neighbours will make one last effort to bring the two sides together in a regional summit. In Congo, heavy fighting's going on between the government and rebels around the town of Goma. Thousands of people are reported to be fleeing. The UN's become involved, saying its peacekeepers had attacked the rebels with helicopter gunships. But in response, mobs have also been stoning UN compounds. The Home Secretary will announce a list of extremists to be banned from entering Britain today. She'll announce a list of radical clerics and other extremists, such as neo-Nazis, who will be turned away at our borders. More than 200 people have been banned in the last 3 years. Now the government has decided to publish all the names. The economy leads most morning papers again. The Guardian and the Financial Times focus on the Bank of England report, both adding that the international markets and the financial systems are still very unstable. The Times tells us that government borrowing will have to rise to £60 billion this year because the drop in city profits means tax revenues will collapse. And the Telegraph picks on the bank's prediction that more than a million homeowners face negative equity as house prices slump. The paper also reports that a French doctor plans to implant the world's first artificial heart. The back pages are shared by Cristiano Ronaldo and Harry Redknapp. Ronaldo won the World Footballer of the Year trophy last night, and the Mirror says that means he belongs to Manchester United body and soul. But the Sun says he only thinks so when asked if he would stay at the club. Redknapp's thought to be chasing some of his old players from Portsmouth to buy them for his new club Spurs. Hands off our stars, Harry, shouts the Star's headline. More on the day's news plus breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
The US Federal Reserve is expected to lead a round of cuts in interest rates later this week after another day of volatility on the markets. There's been a dramatic fall in the value of sterling. Meanwhile, the value of the Japanese currency, the yen, is sky high. In the UK, Alistair Darling is scrapping one of Gordon Brown's golden rules to borrow only what will be invested during that economic cycle. The government wants to increase public spending to cushion the blow of the economic downturn to Britain. Larry Elliott is our economics editor.
Markets are just had another sort of volatile day. It looked like it, at one stage it was going to be another real bloodbath because the Asian markets had very sharp falls overnight on Sunday night, Monday morning. And there was a fear, I think, of a really big widespread panic with the sort of ripple effect from
first from Asia to Europe and then to onto the US. And the London market yesterday was down about 4% at one point. But then Wall Street seemed to regain its nerve a bit. It looked for a while as though Wall Street, the Dow Jones and Wall Street might open 300 points lower. But I think gradually people thought, well, it's a bit absurd this, because actually we're reacting to what happened in the Far East, which in turn was reacting to what was happening in Europe and America on Friday afternoon. And it's a sort of, you know, if you carried on with that for 2 or 3 weeks, you'd end up with share prices worth absolutely zero. So I think people sort of realised there wasn't any real news out in the US or in Europe particularly. And as the day wore on, I think it was the ship steadied a bit.
Did the prospect of a further interest rate cut by the US Federal Reserve and possibly other central banks in the near future steady the nerves of the markets?
I think it did a bit. I mean, I think people expect the US to cut rates later this week. I mean, they have cut them very, very aggressively and they haven't got that much further to go. But I think we expect another half point off US rates this week. There's also a very strong hint from Jean-Claude Trichet, the president of the European Central Bank, that the ECB will cut rates next week. He said it didn't actually signify anything, but even the fact that he said there was a possibility of it means it's pretty much a dead cert that the ECB will cut rates. And then there is the anticipation also that the Bank of England on the same day will cut rates very aggressively in the UK. I mean, a half point cut is very much in the market, and there are people talking about a full percentage point cut, which would take them down to 3.5%. That would be obviously the biggest cut there's been by the Bank of England since it was given independence.
What's going on the money markets? Because there's been steep falls in the value of sterling. Meanwhile, the yen is soaring.
Yes, I mean, sterling. There is some action in sterling still. Sterling was at one point down about 5 cents against the dollar yesterday. And in fact, if you go back to the last time we really had a big sterling crisis in this country, which was in 1992 when we left the ERM, the fall in sterling last week against the dollar was even sharper than it was in the week after we came out of the ERM. And we've seen pretty much the same sort of fall now against the dollar that we saw in 1992, like 50 cents off the value of sterling against the dollar. It's come down from about 201 3 months ago to 152 at its bottom. So there's been a big run on sterling, because I think people are quite nervous about the UK for a couple of reasons. One is the economy looks very poor, and secondly, it was reliant very heavily on inflows of foreign capital into the London market, and a lot of those flows have been reversed in the same way as they have in other countries, to an even greater extent. Countries like Iceland, we're seeing it. Countries like Hungary, we've been seeing it. But the UK is being affected by the same sort of capital flows. Money, hot money came flowing in, and hot money is now coming out of the UK, and that's pushing down the level of sterling. The Japanese are very worried about the level of the yen, which has been rising on the foreign currency markets. And there was quite unusually a statement by the G7 yesterday saying that they were concerned about the overvaluation of the yen, but it doesn't seem to be any willingness to back that up with coordinated action. I mean, normally when central banks show concern, they back it up by selling yen into the market and trying to drive down its value. I don't think there's any real sense of that sort of cooperation amongst the G7, partly because the Europeans are quite happy that the yen is high, because it means that, you know, Japanese exports into Europe are much more expensive. So I don't think the Europeans particularly want to see the yen come down in value. They're quite happy to sign up to a communique, but they're not prepared to actually put their money where their mouth is.
Part of the UK government's response to the downturn is to increase borrowing and public spending. What effect will that have?
Well, I think it really depends on two things. It depends on, one, whether it's matched by an easing of monetary policy. I mean, and secondly, it depends on whether the money is well spent and is targeted on good long-term projects that would be done anyway. If it's just good money thrown after bad into a black hole, then obviously it won't do very much good. The wider point, though, really is that loosening fiscal policy, as it's called, raising public spending or cutting taxes, only tends to work if it goes with the grain of what's happening to interest rates. So if the Bank of England doesn't cut interest rates quickly enough and the economy slides into a massive recession, which is a very real and an imminent danger for the UK, then all you do by actually spending this money is you end up with still a very, very deep recession and very large amounts of public sector debt, which is what happened to Japan in the early 1990s. They responded far too late with cuts in interest rates, and they just carried on with more and more packages of public spending, and they ended up with, you know, huge amounts of public sector debt on which they're still paying large amounts of interest. So that's the danger with it.
Larry Elliott, and you can follow the markets today at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website today, Rory Carroll on what we can learn from Mayan civilization. Read about that at guardian.co.uk/G2. Michelle Hansen, our columnist, on the Russell Brand Jonathan Ross prank call to Andrew Sachs. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. And Britain's greenest cars, from hybrid to electric, Ben Lane looks at the most ecologically conscious driving options at guardian.co.uk/environment/travel and transport. George Osborne has admitted it was a mistake for him to have discussed party fundraising with friends of a Russian oligarch. Meanwhile, Peter Mandelson has rejected calls for him to reveal more details about his relationship with Oleg Deripaska. Mandelson insisted that no conflict of interest arose during his meetings with the controversial Russian billionaire. During an official visit to Moscow this week, the business secretary spoke exclusively to The Guardian's Tom Parfit at his luxury suite in the Baltshug Kempinski Hotel overlooking the Kremlin.
Well, the first question then, if I may, I think a lot of people would just like to know a bit more about why you met Mr. Oleg Deripaska on several occasions.
Because as EU Trade Commissioner, travelling around the world, particularly targeting the fast-growing emerging economies, my job was not only to meet politicians, but to meet the key economic, financial, and bigger business figures as well.
Mm-hmm.
You can't hope to do business and to promote European interests in those economies unless you are meeting people across the range. And in the emerging economies, it's very often the business figures who can open the door to European investment and European trade. So in some cases, you will like some more than others, you will meet some more than others, you will establish acquaintanceships with some. That doesn't mean to say, though, that a conflict of interest arises, and in this case, it didn't.
And just to be clear...
The second question...
May I just clarify?
I'm sorry, Bob. I'm very sorry. I've given you two questions, and you're on your second.
Okay.
I'm being very fair to you.
Thank you very much. I was just hoping to clarify a point on the first question.
You've got two questions, and you're on your second.
Indeed. Okay, thank you very much. About your meeting with Mr. Deripaska, apparently on his yacht off Corfu, can you please tell us exactly... how long you spent on the yacht?
What is important is not where you meet somebody or how long you meet them for, but what you do during the meeting. In my case, I offered no favours, I received no favours, unlike George Osborne, who was holding conversations around his visits in order to obtain a financial contribution to the Conservative Party. So just to widen that point, people ask me how many times have I met Mr. Deripaska. My answer is, how will knowing how many times I have met someone tell you whether I have acted with propriety? That's the key issue. Not how many times, but what I did. Mm-hmm. And the European Commission, which has examined this matter very thoroughly, has confirmed that there was no conflict of interest, no impropriety in any of the arising from any of the meetings I had with Mr. Deripaska. That is absolutely crucial and fundamental, not how many times I met him.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, just to be clear on that question.
You've had your two questions.
I was asking about how long you spent on the yacht.
I'm very sorry.
But you're not prepared to answer.
You've had your two questions. I've answered the two questions, and now you'll have to move on.
Thank you very much.
Peter Mandelson, and there's more from that interview at guardian.co.uk/audio. You can listen to what he says about the Litvinenko affair. I'm John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, the housing development in Cologne that's been described as a gay village.
The 41-year-old theatre director who's planning to move in there said he felt he'd spent his whole life playing a hiding game, and he said he wouldn't have to do that in Villa Anders.
And it's like the credit crunch never happened, a sale of some of the world's priciest but most desirable cars.
There's still quite a bit of money in the marketplace, and there's still quite a bit of interest in buying cars, especially buying something that's tangible that they can use and they can have, and that's something unlike an equity that won't go to zero.
But first, just a week to go before Election Day in America, both Barack Obama and John McCain are flying in and out of the swing states this week trying to win over undecided voters. The candidates were in Ohio yesterday, a crucial battleground in the race for the White House. No Republican has ever captured the White House without winning this state. Ewan McCaskill reports from Dayton.
This is the final stretch of what's been a sort of two-year election campaign. You know, the pace has just sort of picked up. It's become frenetic. Candidates bouncing from state to state at high speed.
With 1 week left in this campaign, the choice facing Americans is stark.
In 1 week, you can put an end to the politics that would divide a nation just to win an election.
Well, Obama sort of billed Monday as the day in which he would give his final message, saying that this was wrapping up the campaign. McCain hasn't quite done that, but he still hasn't established what his message is yet, even at this late stage.
Why would we want to raise taxes on anybody, but most of all, small businesses in America? That's what Senator Obama wants to do.
Part of McCain's problem in this campaign is he keeps switching message from week to week, and sometimes two or three times in the week. But the message that he's sort of finally landed on is to portray Obama as a dangerous liberal who's going to spread wealth. And that doesn't sound so awful to European ears, but in America, for a lot of middle America, conservative centre-right Americans, that is an appalling idea.
Or have it taken by the most liberal person to ever run for the presidency, and the Democratic leaders, the most liberal, who have been running Congress for the past 2 years, Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid. You know, my friends, this is a dangerous threesome.
Obama is also in Ohio today, and Tuesday McCain will be in Pennsylvania, and Obama will also be in Pennsylvania. Wednesday McCain will be in Florida, Obama will also be in Florida, and that reflects the importance of these three states. These are the three key battleground states. You have to win at least two of them, if not three, to win the election.
And now, after 21 months and three debates, Senator McCain still has not been able to tell the American people a single major thing he'd do differently from George Bush when it comes to the economy.
Obama has, he used to go for sort of high-blown rhetoric, inspirational messages and get the crowd going. Over the last few weeks, it's much more reserved, much calmer, and that's the tone he's maintaining. He's taken the Clinton adage, is the economy stupid, and every speech now is about the economy.
Senator McCain says we can't spend the next 4 years waiting for our luck to change. But you understand that the biggest gamble we can take is to embrace the same old Bush-McCain policies that have failed us for the last 8 years. We can't afford to take that risk.
Obama basically has to keep on with the same message for the rest of the week. The election is his to lose now. He doesn't have to do anything except not make a gaffe. Some people say he shouldn't lose momentum, he should be a bit more aggressive in the final week. I don't think that's the case. He's got a big showpiece with Bill Clinton, first time in the campaign, trailed together. He's got his 30-minute long political broadcast that he's paid about $1 million for. He's got lots of high points. He doesn't need to do anything dramatic at this stage.
Ewan McCaskill. Well, next week's elections don't just determine who will become president. Members of the lower house, the House of Representatives, are directly elected every 2 years, as are a third of the 100 senators in the upper house, the Senate. Elana Shaw reports from Washington.
I'm standing on the steps of the Capitol building right now. It's that dome-topped building you see in all of the postcards of Washington where Congress sits. Both houses, the Senate and the House of Representatives, are the two parts of our Congress that write our laws and vote on them in America. Now, 2 years ago, in 2006, Democrats seized control of both parts of Congress. But the only problem was in the Senate, they control just a thin majority. One vote separates them from Republicans. It takes 60 senators to pass really pretty much anything but the simplest bill. So the challenge for Democrats is to get 9 more seats. Right now they have 51 out of 100 senators, and they need to get to 60 to really do anything. Of course, this is extremely challenging because Republicans have a lot of safe positions this year, and the Democrats are working extra hard, spending a lot of money to get these 9 Senate seats that they need. I'm walking down the white marble hallways now, past the office where John Warner, one of the Republican senators, is leaving this office to make way for likely a new Democrat next year. Americans tend to forget how important senators are to their government because during the past 8 years, of course, George Bush has seized so much power for himself, people tend to not think of senators that much anymore. They have a lot of power. One of their biggest powers is the ability to stop a bill cold in its tracks from ever becoming law. That's called filibustering in the term of Congress. It sounds very fancy. All filibustering is stopping business cold. Nothing can be done in the Senate. It grinds to a halt. It takes 60 senators to get rid of a filibuster. So you see now how important it is to get those 9 new Democrats. If they go from 51 to 60, they can stop any filibuster they want. We've crossed the road, and now we're visiting the offices of the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee. This is the arm where all the wannabe senators get together and talk strategy. What cities do we campaign in? Where do we choose to spend our money? Questions like that. Now, in order for Democrats to reach this magic number of 60 senators, they have to fight extra hard in swing states. There are 12 particular swing states for the Democratic Senate. Of course, in these offices, the party must decide how much do we give to each state. Let's take a couple of examples. North Carolina. You have Republican Senator Elizabeth Dole. She is royalty in her party. She was married to Bob Dole, who Americans know well. He ran for president against Bill Clinton. That's not helping Elizabeth this year. Conservatives love her, but Barack Obama is exciting black voters in her state, and she is in a precarious position right now. Another state, Alaska. You tend to think, ooh, Sarah Palin is governor. She's quite popular. But all the bad press she's getting on the presidential campaign is hurting the state Republicans. In addition, the senator currently sitting there, Ted Stevens, Republican from Alaska, he's on trial. 7 criminal counts in a Washington courtroom. And this is another good piece of news for Democrats in Alaska. So this is just 2 of the 12. Things are looking pretty good for Democrats overall, but as any sportsman knows, winning 9 out of those 12 is going to be tough.
Elana Shaw reporting.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
A 6.7 million euro housing project, which will provide homes exclusively for gays, lesbians, transsexuals and their families, is being set up in the German city of Cologne. Our Berlin correspondent, Kate Connolly, says Villa Anders is the first project of its kind in Germany, and more than half the 35 homes have already been sold.
Well, it's called Villa Anders, basically translated as Alternative Villa, and it's a housing project that will provide homes exclusively for gays, lesbians, transsexuals and their families. And it's being set up in the German city of Cologne as an experiment in what the organisers say is multi-generational living, which means that they basically have quotas according to the sexuality and ages of the tenants. So, for example, they want to ensure that at least 30% of the residents will be over the age of 60, that there'll also be room for about 15% of straight residents. That means that it will encourage partners of transsexuals or children of gay couples to also live in the housing project.
And it's in the district of Ehrenfeld in Cologne. What do the locals think?
Well, I was just speaking to the organisers early on, and they said that the locals are fairly open to the project. They've worked, though, very hard at ensuring that the locals have been involved in it from the very start, talking about their voicing their concerns, who the housing project is going to attract, whether it's going to be the right types of people. And the housing project organisers invite the locals to breakfasts and various meetings on a monthly basis in order to keep them informed. Apparently, various projects like this have been started in Germany and other cities over the last 15 years, most of them have failed. One of the main reasons is said to have been that locals were not, or neighbours were not brought into the project, weren't informed about it, so often saw them as a bit of a threat.
Cologne's got a reputation for being relatively tolerant towards gays and lesbians, and it boasts the largest number of gays and lesbians of any German city. So is such a housing project actually needed, separating gays and lesbians from everyone else?
Well, that's it. I mean, you and I might sort of initially think immediately on, you know, be a bit pessimistic and say, is it separating them from the rest of the community? What the organisers say is actually bringing them into the community by making them visible. Living in the Villa Anders, they will be visible to the community. And they say that the ghetto arguments, as they call it, just don't stand up. That what is possible in Cologne is, for example, not possible in other European cities like Warsaw or Moscow, where homophobia is much higher. So they say, first and foremost, it's possible, therefore they're doing it. And it's giving the people that live there, they say, chances that they wouldn't have, or a quality of life that they wouldn't have elsewhere. There is still, in the everyday life of the people who are moving in there, they face a lot of discrimination. They feel they have to explain themselves. And one man, a 41-year-old theatre director who's planning to move in there, said he felt he'd spent his whole life playing a hiding game, and he said that he wouldn't have to do that in Villa Anders.
From Guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
Some of the world's most expensive classic cars are going on sale in London. They include a 1963 Ferrari that's been driven by Charlie's Angels Cameron Diaz and Lucy Liu. That's got a price tag of more than £3 million. Then there's a 1955 Ford Thunderbird, which used to belong to Hollywood actor John Travolta, a snip at £30,000. The Guardian's Sam Jones found out more about the sale at RM Auctions in Battersea in South London.
I'm standing here with Shelby Myers, son of Rob Myers, whose father owns the auction firm, which on Wednesday is hoping to have rather a big sale.
This is the second annual auction that we've done here at Battersea. We're very excited about the auction. We have some magnificent cars, including two private collections. One is a collection of Lancias, coming from an Italian gentleman, and the other is a collection of Andy Saunders' sort of custom cars. Andy's well known here in the UK for coming up with some pretty wild creations. We also have a couple very, very, very important cars, one including a 1963 Ferrari 250 short wheelbase California Spider, used in the Charlie's Angels film Full Throttle. That car is estimated between $5 and $6 million. Another car is an Aston Martin DB5 that was used in the Robbie Williams Millennium video, so that's expected to do rather well, given his provenance.
I noticed rather a lot of Bentleys around here as well.
Yeah, we have a very good, it's an 8-litre Mulliner-bodied Bentley coming from the US. It's very good condition and is a quite notorious provenance. We have an R-Type Continental, 1954, that's quite popular within the market conditions these days, as well as a 3/8-litre Bentley that was formerly raced by John Goddard, a famous driver that broke a world speed record at the time.
And a little way behind us, I notice a car with its polythene wrapper off the back. That's one of the stars of the show. I believe it's a Horch. What can you tell us about that?
That car was found in Latvia in a garage. It's one of six that exists in the world, three of that body style. We restored a car similar to that in 2004 that was that won Best of Show at Pebble Beach, so a very, very important car. And it's very rare, obviously, needing a full restoration, but coachwork by Erdman and Rossi, and it was made in the period to compete with the 540K Mercedes, which we sold last year for $8 million, and that belonged to Bernie Ecclestone, so quite an important piece.
You mentioned Bernie Ecclestone. Last year, RM Auctions sold off rather a lot of his cars while he cleared out his garage. Now, that sale raised £18 million.
Yeah.
What are you expecting from this one?
We have a low estimate of £22 million and a high estimate of £28 million. Given the market conditions, we don't expect sales rates to be as high, but we expect somewhere between 16 and 18 million, so quite similar to last year's results.
And are you expecting a lot of people to come down here with their pockets bulging with money, given the global economic situation?
Yeah, there's still quite a bit of money in the marketplace, and there's still quite a bit of interest in buying cars, especially buying something that's tangible that they can use and they can have, and that's something unlike an equity that won't go to zero. So we're expecting good results, and we have a lot of foreign interest, particularly on a McLaren F1 race car, one of a limited production number built, and it was actually the McLaren's Park Lane show car, so a very important piece. And so a lot of international attention, and we're expecting a good result.
Sam Jones reporting. Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey produced today's show. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.